Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. For the sixth year in a row, fuel efficiency will decline for most 1992 car models, but Detroit is only building what we're asking for. Luxury and power over high mileage, we'll have a report. Also this time, internationally known expert on groundwater contamination, Dr. John Cherry, tells us about the toxic effects of home septic systems and an interesting irony.
The public who will get up in arms about a landfill siting in general won't at all realize that their septic systems are probably doing more damage than the landfill that they're busy protesting and wanting in someone else's backyard. So to a large degree, I think much of the battle is one of education and proper research.
And now we can recycle bottles, newspaper, metal, and highways, a new technique using microwaves. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Recently, the Environmental Protection Agency released results of tests on next year's new cars, rating their fuel efficiency. It comes as no surprise to market analysts that next year's models are not going to show an improvement, but in fact will actually show a slight decline. According to the study, the average will hover around 27.5 miles per gallon. That's down from last year's 27.8 miles per gallon. Observers on both sides of the issue say this is the sixth year in a row that ratings have declined. The debate is over whether this need be so. John DeSico is a research associate specializing in transportation issues at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
The basic issue is what one calls a market failure. In the automobile showroom, our values when we're at the floor with the salesman looking at the cars is somewhat different than our social values. The risk of the environmental damage, the risk of oil security and disruptions, and all of these things are not apparent in the showroom. And this is the basic reason why regulation is called for. The costs, all the costs of our rising petroleum use are not reflected in the low current cost of gasoline. Therefore, fuel economy is not a big seller. There's an economy niche of the market, without a doubt. There's certain people for whom fuel economy is very important, but it's not the largest part of the market. And the manufacturers, because in many ways it's easier for them, and I suppose it's part of a corporate culture approach to the situation too, push other attributes of vehicles, push power performance, push luxury, and the like. And so you have this heavy advertising onslaught that also works against whatever inclinations people have for fuel economy.
On Capitol Hill are bills in both houses calling for an increase in the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE, standards. Moderate legislation would have the CAFE at 40 miles per gallon within a few years. Others are calling for a major increase of 60 miles per gallon by early next century. Others argue that instead of mandating higher CAFE standards, better instead we should raise taxes, taxes that would bring additional revenue as well as act as a disincentive to driving. DeSico says,
and they're really just all wet. The small kinds of taxes we're talking about would do something like increase the cost of driving from like 6.3 cents a mile to 6.6 cents a mile. And that's not going to substantially change people's behavior. It's not going to change their behavior in vehicle selection in the showroom. And even if it would, without some sort of regulation to require the industry to reach efficiency, they're not going to have a broad selection of efficient vehicles. An important thing about the regulation, the target that has been set is a very moderate target, making a 40% improvement, which coincidentally would get the fleet to about 40 miles per gallon, does not require any downsizing whatsoever. The size of the cars was held constant in the engineering analyses that we and others have done to estimate what is technically feasible 10 years from now. So that's part of the, I think, misinformation that's out there, that downsizing of the fleet would be required.
Mike Stanton, Director of Federal Relations at the Motor Vehicle Manufacturing Association, says the big changes in CAFE standards came as a result of the oil embargoes of the 1970s.
Manufacturers met the challenge of building more fuel-efficient vehicles by introducing new technology, certainly, but also by taking out over 1,000 pounds by reducing the weight of the vehicle. We have been able to maintain the interior space pretty much, but the cars of today are much shorter. They have a shorter wheelbase and are much lighter than the cars of the 1975 time frame. And I think also consumers were very conscious about fuel efficiency, and the fuel efficiency was a factor that they used in determining which vehicle they were going to purchase. Today, the price of fuel is really at an all-time low if you standardize for current dollars back to 1981, and fuel efficiency is not a terribly important ingredient for a consumer when he goes to buy a vehicle. So I think we see a number of things happening, certainly the weight reduction, but then the consumer demand has changed tremendously over the last 10 years.
Stanton says proposed legislation to increase CAFE standards just would not be effective for a number of reasons.
Number one, we can't get that same 1,000 pounds out of the vehicles again. That would mean that we would definitely have to downsize in interior volume, and with that means that there's going to be less consumer choice, and there's also going to be some severe safety consequences of that kind of downsizing. The other thing is today we are building a number of cars that get in excess of 40 miles per gallon. Unfortunately, only 2% of the buying public want these vehicles. So if Congress were to mandate that we build cars that consumers don't like, we think there would be a tremendous loss of jobs and economic disruption that would be totally unwarranted.
That's simply false. And in fact, some trends that are happening with this downward trend in fuel economy very much reveal that. Acceleration ability in cars has been improving at the same time, and there's a very direct trade-off in engines between optimizing them for fuel economy versus power performance. So the manufacturers have, in fact, been putting new technology into the cars, and that technology is being used, but in different ways. They're increasing top speed ability, which now is near 120 miles per hour. They have cut acceleration times in the cars over the past few years. According to the EPA correlations, that penalty as of last year was over a mile per gallon. And although I haven't had a chance to review all the latest figures for the new fleet, I'm sure that trend is also continuing.
DeSico at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy says we can achieve better fuel efficiency through the use of better and lighter construction materials and improvement in engine design, as well as scaling back the size of the cars that we are demanding. According to the EPA, leading the pack next year in highest mileage will be the Geo Metro XFI, with 58 miles per gallon on the highway, 53 in town. The others in the top 10 include many of the Honda Civic models. At the bottom of the list are vehicles such as the Lamborghini Diablo, using a gallon every 14 miles on the highway and 9 in the town. This is Bruce Robertson. When most of us think of recycling, we think of aluminum cans, glass, paper, even tires. But what about recycling roads? According to research from the EPA, 100 million tons of asphalt concrete are ripped up every year, and about 80% of that is taking up space in landfills. Carl Hutchison is the president and chief executive officer of Cyclion, a company that recycles the asphalt concrete on old roads and airport runways. He says recycling other items often results in an end product of lesser quality that's also more expensive. But asphalt has some unusual advantages.
We recycled for the city of Los Angeles 200,000 tons of asphalt. The advantages of that in numbers were this. That means that roughly 200,000 tons of old asphalt didn't have to go into a landfill. That means that roughly 200,000 tons or 95% of the 200,000 tons of rock did not have to come out of a rock quarry, or, you know, it was completely recovered, so we didn't need to get new rock. That saved 60,000 barrels of oil just in the process in 1 year. And the monetary savings to the city of Los Angeles, according to their own numbers, was $1.5 million.
Hutchison may be in a $12 billion market, and he says his company is still pretty small. Cyclion was founded in 1986, and there are plants in the city of Los Angeles and in the states of Georgia and Texas, along with some portable units. He says he can pack up a portable plant in about 15 tractor trailers and then reassemble it on site in other cities. But Hutchison says road recycling still has not captured the public's imagination.
Public reaction has been almost ambivalent, and the reason is they don't, if you tell them you're recycling highways and airport runways, that doesn't really register on them. If we told them we were recycling rubber tires, that would register on them more.
One problem for Hutchison is that potential customers just do not believe that he can do it. He says companies have been trying for years to develop a process that can recycle asphalt in its entirety. But a problem arose when they tried to reheat and remelt the asphalt mixture so it could be laid back down on the road. The mixture is made from aggregate or ground-up stones and asphalt cement, the binding ingredient. This is what paves the road. The problem arose when the companies tried to reheat this mixture.
If you do that improperly, you expose the old asphalt, which is coated with, it's oil-coated. You expose that to a direct flame, which is about 2,500 to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Two things happen. A lot of smoke is one, but the worst thing that happens is it destroys the cementitious qualities of the oil. It turns it into black dust.
To solve the problem, Hutchison tried to heat the aggregate rock in the mixture instead of the oil product. So he used microwave heat.
The way the microwave works is it sets up a magnetic field in the aggregate and causes the molecules in the aggregate to vibrate. The molecules in the aggregate are like little compass needles, and since the magnetic field reverses itself millions of times a second, these molecules are vibrating, and when they vibrate, they create heat. And the heat is created uniformly in the rock, just as it is created uniformly in a piece of meat or a piece of bread that we put in a kitchen microwave. Only these industrial microwave generators that we use are many times more powerful and equally as safe as a kitchen microwave. The strange part about this is the asphalt cement, the black oil that is in the old mixture, does not respond as quickly to the microwave energy field as the rock does. So we don't heat it. It is heated by conduction heat coming from the aggregate itself.
Hutchison says this process means his company is the only one that can recycle 100% of the asphalt using very few new resources. Others have to mix in some new rock and new oil with the old. But before a road is turned back into a hot paving mixture, there are a few steps to take. First, a company has to figure out how to tear up the road or runway. Hutchison says there are two common methods. One is a big piece of machinery called a front-end loader that picks up the old asphalt in big chunks, and then the chunks are delivered to the company where they are crushed into pieces no more than a half inch long. But Mike Miles, the operation manager for Cyclion, says milling machines do an even better job. He describes how one of these units works.
It's like a drum with teeth on it, and it's spinning at a very high rate, and it has carbide-tipped teeth on it. It can grind that road down very quickly. And behind it is like a pan, just like when you're sweeping and you have that pan that you sweep into to get all the stuff that you swept up with, and it catches it in the back, and it goes into a conveyor. It just, the force of the spinning drum kind of throws it behind the machine.
Miles says the drum can be raised and lowered depending on how much of the road will be torn up. When the old asphalt reaches the plant, it is all mixed together and then sifted to get rid of any garbage. Hutchison says he's found old car radios and traffic pylons in the mixture. Next, the asphalt is dumped into a special rotary kiln where hot air removes all the moisture. The asphalt must be completely dry when it is recycled. While it is drying, the mixture reaches a temperature just over 200 degrees Fahrenheit. Then it is transferred into the microwave tunnel where it reaches 300 degrees and becomes hot mix or liquid. With that, it is ready for the paving machine. But with all that heating and moving, one would expect some hazardous byproducts. Hutchison admits this has been a serious stumbling block for other recyclers.
In our case, any emissions that we cannot incorporate back into the mix by coating them with asphalt are thrown off in two ways. One is the conventional way where excessive fines or silt or dirt are cleared from the asphalt mix during the process and taken out by a giant vacuum cleaner, which the industry calls a baghouse. The other offcast from the process is polluted air, and as I said, that is not recovered into the asphalt mixture itself is burned and 98% destroyed before it goes into the atmosphere.
These emissions are burned in a unit called a thermal oxidizer, which is like an incinerator. He says this is so effective, the Los Angeles plant was 83% below the requirements set by the South Coast Air Quality Management Board, whose guidelines are known to be some of the most stringent in the nation. In the process, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and a small amount of volatile organic compounds are released. But Hutchison believes the industry as a whole is making improvements. And so is Cyclion. The company has been contacted by people in other states, like officials at the New York State Thruway. He's also received a grant from the Army Corps of Engineers to develop a new system that will pick up the asphalt, recycle it, and lay it back down in a continuous process. Hutchison says his company is about 3 or 4 years ahead of the competition, but he says he's not ready to take a break yet. He only has about 100 million tons of asphalt to go. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. The Federal Superfund program began in 1980, the result of the tragic discoveries at Love Canal in Niagara, New York. During the 1930s and 40s, it is estimated up to 20,000 tons of toxic chemicals were buried in the abandoned canal, later to become a residential area. In 1980, the Superfund consisted of $1.5 billion targeted on 6,000 sites around the nation. Today, there are more than 20,000 sites, and some estimate remediation will run as high as $600 billion. As experts debate the costs and techniques of cleanup, meanwhile, another massive problem is being created quietly, yet with full participation of both industry and science. At the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, Dr. John Cherry is a research scientist at the Center for Groundwater Research. We spoke with Dr. Cherry during a recent symposium on science, technology, and the environment held at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Dr. Cherry is one of the most respected and skilled consultants in the field of groundwater contamination, and he has been studying the effects of individual homeowner septic systems on groundwater supplies.
The standard septic system varies little from state to state or country or province to province. And the standard septic system, properly built, properly licensed, takes out, 90 or 95% of the contamination from the water. It does a good job of that. But in fact, it allows essentially all of the nitrogen to reach the water table. And the nitrogen gets converted to nitrate. And nitrate, in fact, has a limit of 10 milligrams per liter nitrogen in federal drinking water standards. It takes a long time, but as you add housing divisions in suburban and near urban areas, and as time goes on, and nitrogen contamination from septic systems and from agriculture, in fact, is the world's most widespread, serious groundwater problem. And to combat that, either we've got to stop building homes with a standard septic system and connect people up to sewers, or else we're going to have to, I think, invest massively and have legislation to encourage it, use of alternative septic systems. There are possibilities of building septic systems that clean the water up to a much better degree.
What would be some of the alternatives for a rural homeowner that is not near a town or a village type of a sewer treatment system. They have the septic tank, 1,000 gallons, say, with a drain field, which is a built-in polluter. What are the alternatives?
Well, the alternative in that case, where one is far from a sewer system, really is the use of alternative septic systems. And there are three or four being tried out on a very preliminary way in the United States and Canada, and there's some alternatives in Europe. However, because legislation has not recognized the septic system problem, and because most of us didn't realize it until a few years ago, there hasn't really been the demand. Demand is usually driven by legislation, but I think that if governments are willing to recognize the problem and produce a demand, that the private sector, I think, will respond very rapidly to alternative systems. They'll cost a little bit more, but they'll be environmentally much, much better.
Can you describe some of these alternative systems?
Well, the area where the conventional septic system fails, it is its transfer of nitrogen from human waste and foods to the water table. So what the septic system needs, it needs to do everything that a conventional septic system does well, and it needs to have a component to it that in fact takes the nitrogen and converts it from nitrate, NO3, to nitrogen gas. That's called denitrification. Basically all of the alternative septic systems that I know of being developed are hinging their success on that objective, getting rid of the nitrogen. There are other issues of septic systems. For example, viruses in cooler parts of the northern U.S. and Canada can live a long time in groundwater, and almost nothing is known about how viruses get out of septic systems into aquifers. So my starting point really is to look at the nitrate issue. And if we can get a solution to that, then move on to other possible problems. Who knows? Maybe viruses.
Would the treatment of the transferring it to the nitrogen gas, would that be brought about through some kind of additive or a new process of where would this be taking place, within the tank itself or before it goes into the tank?
Well, there are various concepts. One concept for an alternative septic system would be to have basically three tanks. The conventional septic system has a tank and a line and a bunch of drains, so maybe that you'd hook another tank to it. Another possibility is to have the tank and the drains and put a different layer below the drains in the ground. So rather than rip up your front yard and just put a gravel layer in and put your pipes in it, you would put some other layers below it so that the water trickles through a different type of soil. In essence, though, you have to have additives. And the additives have to make bacteria flourish that will cause denitrification to occur. So you have to keep natural bacteria that are inherent in all soils happy and thriving on nitrogen.
Jerry says we are overdue in understanding that groundwater is in a hydrologic cycle, entering the system as rain or snow mostly, passing briefly through the soil into rivers, streams, wetlands, and estuaries, only to be taken again back into the atmosphere. If we are serious about managing the environment as a whole, Dr. Cherry says we need to look at this whole system of water.
The part, though, that has caused groundwater to, shall we say, not be a mainline issue environmentally until very recently is that in many cases it takes an awful long time for our mistakes to show up. In other words, it takes a long time for the chemicals we put into the ground to actually come out or have an impact. And those lengths of time then are often, are usually more than years, and quite often in a matter of decades, and in many cases in a matter of centuries. So, in fact, some, if not much, of the contamination that's getting into people's wells at the present time is contamination caused years or decades ago. And that makes it difficult then for society to realize what the problem is, and it also makes it difficult for politicians to pass the type of legislation that's needed to truly protect groundwater, because the payoff, in many cases, isn't going to be in their career.
Dr. Cherry says if little has been known about the effects of toxic chemicals above ground, that much less is known about what these chemicals may be doing to groundwater.
There have been generations of scientists and engineers educated, not realizing really what the groundwater issues were. And unfortunately, there were no Rachel Carsons in the groundwater field. There was no one of prominence standing up and warning society in the 60s or 70s as what was going on. And even the septic system issue, I mean, public who will get up in arms about a landfill siting, in general, won't at all realize that their septic systems are probably doing more damage than the landfill that they're busy protesting and wanting in someone else's backyard. So to a large degree, I think much of the battle is one of education and proper research.
Dr. John Cherry, professor of earth sciences at the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. He is a recognized specialist in groundwater contamination and, as such, was a featured speaker at a recent symposium on science, technology, and the environment held at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, do drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York, and the zip is 12206. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. That's 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show number 92. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.